Good afternoon. Hey, there we go. Any response is great. It's after lunch, so that's okay. Thank you so much for coming along. Hopefully you found the keynote this morning useful and some interesting stuff in there. My name is Matt McSpirit. I'm a technical evangelist, Microsoft, from England, based in Redmond. And it's my job to help our customers, our partners, or generally our IT professionals, like you and I, to understand our on-premises technology, Windows Server, Hyper-V, storage, networking, Azure Stack, the Operations Management Suite, and all of the other technologies that Microsoft is bringing to the market. But in this session, we're going to be revisiting something I used to spend all of my time doing, which was looking at VMware and Hyper-V. So it's a nice kind of full circle for me because, yeah, I don't tend to focus on it as much anymore, but it's still something I'm very passionate about. And what I want to do in the session is ensure that you go away with an understanding that both Microsoft with Hyper-V and our Windows Server technology and VMware both offer a great solution to the virtualization challenges you have out there. It's not necessarily that one is way better than the other. And what we'll find when we talk about the landscape very briefly, and this is my perspective on the landscape, you'll find that virtualization is starting to drop down the level of priorities for both Microsoft and VMware in terms of what you see both of our companies' strategies going forward. Virtualization is very important, but there's lots of other technologies on top of virtualization that are becoming more and more important. So for instance, virtualization is so commoditized now, it's so common, that it's almost like how much do we have to continue to deliver in virtualization that's enough for most organizations. And I think we're very close to that with Hyper-V and vSphere in the current set of releases. So we'll talk a little bit about the landscape. We'll talk about compute, storage, and networking. They're the core of Windows Server. And a little bit about security, because that's incredibly important, and it's a unique differentiator for Hyper-V, for sure, in 2016. There's some very unique features that are delivered in the operating system that really enable you to lock down the infrastructure, more so than ever before. And then we'll wrap up with some resources. So when we think about the landscape, I mentioned this just a minute ago. The strategy of Microsoft and VMware, it's not that virtualization is no longer important. Absolutely not. Virtualization is still very, very important. It's a core feature of our platform, Hyper-V. It's VMware's most popular product in their portfolio, vSphere. But what you've seen over the last 12, 24, 36 months is a shift. A shift in technologies that are being delivered by Microsoft and VMware beyond just Hyper-V. So we think about Microsoft. Think about storage, software-defined storage, storage spaces direct. New technologies that are really going to change the way Microsoft delivers storage. For VMware, technologies like vSAN, very popular. Customers are adopting that pretty quickly, 3,000 customers, I think, in 21 months. So vSAN, VMware's virtual SAN technology, their software-defined storage initiative, is gaining popularity. And it's an area of investment for VMware that's very significant. When we think about networking, software-defined networking in the Microsoft stack, in Windows Server, is gaining more and more capabilities and is becoming more and more powerful as we bring new functionality from Azure and we build new technologies into the platform. VMware are very similar. New versions of NSX, their network virtualization technology, more and more capabilities, more and more features. And it's only as we continue through this trend we see the importance of these new areas of investment beyond just the hypervisor. If you think back, I don't know, three or four vSphere releases ago. So you've got vSphere 6 now, 5.5, 5.1, 5, 4.1, and so on. Like 4.1 and 5, when there was an announcement of what the features were, it was huge news. It was fanfares. There was significant lists of new features in each release. And it was the same for Hyper-V. Huge lists of features. But you look now at vSphere 6, and you look at Hyper-V in Windows Server 2016, and there's a lot of improvements to existing features. And there's a couple of headline new features, but not the same as it was 3 or 4 years ago, or 3 or 4 releases ago, when the list was very long. And it reflects a change in the landscape, that it's not just about the virtualization layer anymore. People are thinking about storage, networking, containers, nanoservers, Azure Stack type technology, automation, management, all of those other aspects that are now getting a lot more focus. But when we think about virtualization specifically, there are a lot of you still out there who are making decisions. Maybe you're with VMware today and you're approaching a end of contract and you're thinking, do we stay with VMware? It's given us great returns over the years. Do we evaluate something different like Hyper-V? These are very common customer conversations that we still have. So even though Microsoft's focus is delivering innovation in storage, networking, virtualization, management, Azure Stack, and so on, we still want to help you have that virtualization comparison discussion. Now, when we think about aiding that discussion, it used to be that there was a lot of material on the web that you could find that was very pro Hyper-V versus VMware. And at the same time, you could search a different set of websites and find some very pro VMware documentation. VMware's better here and here and here. Hyper-V's better here, here, and here. There's not as much of that around anymore, because both platforms, both vSphere 6 and Windows Server 2012 R2 Hyper-V and Windows Server 2016 Hyper-V, are strong virtualization platforms. Very, very strong. They deliver more than enough functionality for 90% of the organizations out there who are virtualizing stuff. Think about Hyper-V. You might think, well, Hyper-V's market share in enterprises is a lot lower than VMware's. Yeah, that's fair. It's quite a bit lower. VMware has that maturity, that time in market that's given it a head start. But then we flip it around and we think about the public cloud, and Hyper-V powers Azure, and the footprint of Hyper-V is suddenly huge, with a ginormous number of virtual machines running virtualized in Azure, and they're running on Hyper-V. So we believe that the functionality, the technology that is now Hyper-V, has reached a level that gives most organizations more than enough virtualization power. You don't see many comparison benchmarks anymore, like vSphere can virtualize 20 more VMs on a host than Hyper-V. vSphere performs SQL Server better than Hyper-V. You just don't see those anymore, because both platforms deliver such great performance for your workloads, near physical performance, that it's very tricky to prove one over the other, and in many cases, unnecessary. They're both going to give you great performance for your workloads. However, you do occasionally stumble across some documents that you think, that's an interesting read. And this was one of them. I had a look through, and I thought, you know, I'm an objective guy. I'm pretty fair when I do my comparisons. I don't try to be biased towards one or the other. But there's some stuff in there that's a little bit curious for me. Some stuff is justified, and I've given you the link. You can take a look for yourself. But I'm going to discuss some of those key comparisons and talk about some of the key advantages, I think, for Hyper-V in reflection of this document. But we've got to start with some speeds and feeds. Everybody loves big numbers. So when we used to put this up, it was always an interesting battle with Hyper-V and VMware, because our releases were staggered. So Hyper-V would come out with a release, and then a couple of months later, it would be vSphere, and then a little bit further down the line, there'd be another Hyper-V update, and so on. So we'd always be vying for this first place in scalability. And then it got to the 2012 and 2012 R2 timeframe, and things just went crazy. It was like, who owns these physical servers that are this big? Because some of them are just huge. When you think about what's supported with vSphere 6 Enterprise Plus, the highest SKU that VMware do for vSphere, who has a server that's got 480 logical processors? I don't. I would like one, and I'm guessing it would be quite expensive, but that's a big server, big server with the 6 terabytes of memory. And in fact, vSphere supports 12 terabytes on certain OEM hardware. So again, who has a 12 or 6 terabyte server? They're not that common. Even when we think about Hyper-V only supporting 4 terabytes of physical memory, only. It's tiny. I mean, how do you even run a virtual machine on there? It's so small. My point is, you're not going to run out of capacity on these kind of servers. So when it comes to a scale discussion, both platforms are going to give you more than enough to virtualize your most mission-critical workloads. On the Hyper-V numbers on the left, our studies show that 99% of the world's SQL servers can now be virtualized on Hyper-V confidently. Even the SQL servers that are doing a lot of in-memory workloads with like SQL Server 2014 and 2016. So we're confident that we're delivering the right level of scale for your workloads. Now, are these numbers final? Well, if you see in my little environment here, I can't zoom in, but you see the little one? These numbers are subject to change. This is technical preview 5. Oh, there you go, great. Look at that. Who'd have thought? So my RDP session goes this morning. Now PowerPoint stops working. Does anyone want to buy a laptop? Surface for sale, one previous owner. So from the top, welcome. Nice to have you. Let's go through the landscape. Let's go through. No, I'm kidding. So let's. That's a first. I've never had PowerPoint crash on me in a session before. Wow. So when you think about the size of the virtual machines, we're covered, both on vSphere and Hyper-V. Yes, I've highlighted vSphere in green here, because it's bigger. Fine. But these systems are so big now that you just don't need to worry. It's just not something you would think about. You don't go to Dell's website or HP's or IBM's or Fujitsu's or whoever's and look for the, you don't start with the 12 terabyte server, you know, in your shopping list. Realistically, servers in our labs, in the customers are buying are much smaller, but still more than enough for their needs, and Hyper-V will fully support that. When we think about some of the other key considerations from that document, this is where it starts to get a little bit, not frustrating for me when I read it. I just think, that's a little bit unfair to position Hyper-V in that way. But then, you know, it's a marketing and sales document. What would you expect? But reading it, you would think, wow, Hyper-V really sucks because there's a lot of red crosses on the Hyper-V side. When in reality, that's not actually the case. So yes, vSphere is a purpose-built hypervisor. VMware are a virtualization company. But in a short time scale with Hyper-V, Microsoft has gone from building its own hypervisor, introducing it in Windows Server, completely different architecture to VMware, microkernelized versus monolithic. And we've gone from that initial Windows Server 2008 version, which was tough. You know, there was a lot of learning to be made. Anybody who deployed it and was there and got the scars and the black eye and everything, you know it was a little bit tough to start with. But when it hit 2012 and 2012 R2, Hyper-V was a real solid offering, a real solid hypervisor. So what that it requires a Windows Server OS? There's hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of workloads out there running on this general purpose OS for customers like yourselves. And it's providing a great solution. Yeah, and Linux is getting more popular as well at the same time, but that doesn't mean that Windows Server is a bad thing to have associated with Hyper-V. It has very much licensing benefits by integrating with Hyper-V, and it's easy to deploy and manage with familiar tools. So all very beneficial. When we think about this one, the attack surface, it sounds very dramatic. Small attack surface, watch out. You think vSphere, wow, it is tiny, 158 meg on disk. Yeah, the hypervisor is very small. But because Hyper-V requires Windows Server OS, we get the whole package added in our size comparison. When in fact, Hyper-V is about the size of the driver for this mouse. It's incredibly small, an incredibly lightweight hypervisor footprint. It's just because it's packaged within Windows Server, server core being 5 gig, full install being 13 gig approximately, It gets this bad reputation as being bulky and bloated and full of stuff that we don't need from just a hypervisor. And some of it is fair. If you want just a hypervisor, why don't we give you just a hypervisor? And we kind of did that with a product called Hyper-V Server. You may have heard of it. It's a free download, has all the features for Hyper-V. It was still about 3 or 4 gig in size, maybe approaching 5, but it just did Hyper-V and clustering, and it was as close to the just virtualization hypervisor approach as people wanted. However, things are changing, and I'll talk about how in a minute. But the final area that I want to just touch on before I show some Microsoft alternatives and give some comeback is around patching. Now, yes, vSphere doesn't have unrelated patches apart from to the hypervisor. And yes, they've got a great mechanism for automating patch deployment. vCenter is a great management tool. Anybody who's got VMware will know that. It's a solid tool to enable you to patch and update and upgrade your vSphere hosts. But it leaves out one big part, is it doesn't actually patch your guests. That's a completely separate experience and a completely separate mechanism for you to patch and maintain the guest operating systems, Windows or Linux, that are running on your vSphere platform. So yes, you can simplify the patching of the hosts, but you still need something else to patch all of your guests, assuming you do, which, being good IT professionals, I would hope that's the case. So yes, on the Microsoft side, if you were patching your Hyper-V host, and you would be applying certain Windows patches associated with that that may not be specific to Hyper-V. So you think, well, am I patching unnecessarily? Am I wasting my time? I'm deploying a lot of patches that don't really matter to Hyper-V because you've got that Windows Server OS around Hyper-V. And that brings us to how we're starting to deliver solutions that meet that need of just give me the virtualization platform, just give me the hypervisor, and simplify how I administer and maintain it. And that's where NanoServer comes in. NanoServer, if you've not heard about it, if you've not seen any sessions that talk about it, NanoServer is our next generation future of Windows Server. And I'm not saying that to be bold and dramatic. NanoServer is the future of Windows Server, full stop. NanoServer is a zero footprint, technically not true, it's not zero, but it starts very, very small. Zero footprint, 64-bit only, headless, so no UI, slight lie, I'll show you why in a minute, but a headless, for the most part, deployment option of Windows Server. So it's not a license, you don't buy NanoServer, you buy Windows Server, and you choose to deploy NanoServer. However, the benefit it gives is it's just enough of the operating system. And what I mean by that is, if I want this NanoServer that I've got the image for here to be a Hyper-V host, I just turn on the Hyper-V functionality and deploy the image. If I need this NanoServer to be a file server, I just turn on the storage components. In fact, I don't turn them on, I add them to my NanoServer image and then deploy. And that's very important because, as I said, it's a zero footprint model to start. So NanoServer by default, the image has no packages, but you need to make it do something. So in this case, we want it to be a Hyper-V host, so we add the Hyper-V package and it gets a little bit bigger. We want it to have all the OEM drivers necessary to run on a variety of hardware. So we add the OEM drivers package, and it gets a little bit bigger. And then we deploy. And the size on disk of NanoServer varies based on how many packages you add. If you added all the packages, it would get a little bit bigger. But it starts at about 120, 150 megabytes for a full Windows Server. Compare that to the 5 gig and 13 gig, and we're already getting very close to that minimal footprint, that reduced attack surface. As you add more packages, that grows, and I think a Hyper-V host with clustering and storage, you're probably looking at around about 400 to 500 megabytes. So yes, not as small as vSphere. No, absolutely not. Remember, the hypervisor bit is very, very small. But what that enables us to do, it opens up a whole new set of options around how quickly we can deploy a new Hyper-V host and the different ways we can deploy. Now, you compare that to Server Core and the full GUI edition, and they're not to scale. Somebody has drawn these boxes that they pretty much match alternative. If this was to scale, NanoServer would be very, very thin. It's about 20, 25 times smaller than a Server Core. So when you boot it, it boots in seconds, single-digit seconds. Yes? Good question. Is there any plans to make it run stateless? Now, it's a great segue, and I thank you for the question. Because if you'd have asked me that yesterday, I would have said, I'm not sure. But this morning, I had a revelation on TechNet, and that's not something you will hear often. I had a revelation on TechNet and saw some documentation that we haven't really talked about publicly. And I'm thinking, this is a big deal. And I see it listed on TechNet, and I'll show you in a second. But yeah, essentially, we're going to be able to run in RAM. And I was like, that's a result. And I'll talk about it in context a bit later on. But remember, this nano server, we are talking about it in the context of Hyper-V. But it could be your file servers for your storage infrastructure. It could be a guest OS for your applications and workloads. So it's not just useful for Hyper-V. But NanoServer is really, in this first release, Windows Server 2016, it's really about those two scenarios. Infrastructure, so Hyper-V, clustering, storage, networking, and guest OS to run containers and other applications. So when we think about that NanoServer, I don't know where my middle graphic has gone there, but if we bring those in, and PowerPoint not my strong point. When we think about that hypervisor, no reliance on a general purpose OS. Okay, fine, if you want to put it in those terms. But the reality is that Hyper-V as part of Windows Server powers the biggest, arguably one of the biggest public clouds in the world and powers a lot of enterprises and small businesses. So we should be confident in the fact that having Windows Server and Hyper-V as a single package isn't a bad thing. But then when you think about that disk footprint, if it really matters to you, which it shouldn't, but if it really does matter to you, NanoServer is a great way to start to reduce that footprint. Not only the disk footprint shrinks, but also the number of ports that are open is reduced, the number of services that are running reduced, the number of patches reduced. All of those things matter. And that's where NanoServer is very beneficial to a virtual infrastructure. And then when we think about patching your virtualization hosts is only one part of your overall story. You know as well as I do that patching the virtual infrastructure is one element, but I've got to think about my guests and my applications and the workloads. So patching is more about a strategy than the actual technology itself. There are lots of tools you can use to deploy patches and maintain an infrastructure and workloads. So having a solution like WSUSE, SCCM, other system center tools or other third-party tools that can patch everything is very useful. Now, I wanted to quickly duck into my environment here. I'm going to give the game away. But for those who haven't seen NanoServer, it has the best UI of any product. There you go. What could get more simple than that? Oops, let me log in. I think the term is more is less. Is that what people say? Or less is more? That's it. I mean, wow. I mean, we can do photos by it. It's epic. It's cool. But that's Nano. So I said it's GUI-less. There's no UI. You can see there's some sort of UI. But this is, as the name says at the top, the recovery console. You only really use this as a last resort. Maybe if this was a physical server running Nano, maybe you've been disconnected from the network for some reason. So you walk over with your crash cart and you plug in your monitor and keyboard and you log in locally and fix the network. And there's a few things that you can do. So you can fix the network, you can adjust firewall rules, tweak WinRM. Now this is technical preview 5. If you'd have gone back to technical preview 1 or 2 or 3, you wouldn't have seen some of these things here, like the ability to adjust the network settings or the ability to change firewall. And they've been introduced because we've been listening to customer feedback about NanoServer and what people would like to be able to do in this kind of console. So just give you a few controls and management options. But the real strength in Nano is managing it remotely. Now you think, well, how do I deploy a nano server? Do I do it in the same way that I do with a regular Windows server? Well, it's a little bit different. One of the ways, and there are a few, is to use PowerShell. So we give you PowerShell modules to enable you to deploy nano server images quickly, and so you can incorporate it into your automation routines. I need a new nano server to do Hyper-V. I need a new nano server to be file server. And it's so straightforward. New nano server image. Is it going to be a virtual machine? Guest. Is it going to be a physical host? Host. They're your two options. Where are the files you're going to pull from on the Windows Server disk or the DVD? Do you want to create a virtual hard disk? Yes. Give it a name. And there's also other options you can include. Like if I wanted this to be a storage node, I choose dash storage. If I needed this to be a Hyper-V node, I would choose dash compute. And all of those flags that I'm adding essentially tweak this nano server image to be something specific. And then when I execute, out pops my virtual hard disk that's ready to deploy. So it's a different approach, but something that's very easy to adopt and automate. Now, going back to the question, I've come a long way round to answer it. This is what I was looking at in the documentation this morning, and it's way down, well, over halfway down the documentation on the Nano Server page. If I scroll to the top, you'll see it's just getting started with Nano Server. And what you'll see is if I scroll back down, somewhere around here, running Nano Server from a RAM disk. We have made no noise about this whatsoever, but I think this is huge. Because even though Nano Server is very small on disk, 300-400 megabytes, maybe even smaller, if you've got diskless servers, this gives you an option to now connect over the network and essentially pixie your Nano Servers to lots of physical servers that have no disks. So as long as you've got the accompanying unattend files and the accompanying management control, you can very quickly deploy Nano Servers out to your environment. So having it run in RAM is pretty powerful. And I'll talk about how this compares with some vSphere stuff very shortly. But Nano Server is certainly a very important strategic position and direction for Microsoft. And as I said at the start, it's the future of Windows Server. So yes, today you'll still have the desktop GUI version of Windows Server, you'll still have Server Core, but now you also have Nano Server. Do I recommend you go out and deploy all of your servers as Nano Server? Well, if you'd like, but you know, use caution. It's still it's a change. It's a different approach. You can still manage it with your System Center tools, so you can still be confident in controlling it. Now, when we think about management of memory, there was a couple of years ago where Hyper-V didn't have any advanced memory management technology. You created a VM, you gave it 4 gig of RAM, and your host lost 4 gig of RAM. You created a VM that with 20 gig of RAM, even if the VM only needed 2, you lost 20 gig of RAM. And at that time, VMware had a very clear density advantage because they had advanced technology like memory ballooning that ensured that you could give VMs a minimum and maximum memory and remove memory from VMs when it doesn't need the memory, give memory back to VMs when it did, and essentially a more efficient way of managing memory. Hyper-V didn't have anything like that. But fast forward to 2008 R2 Service Pack 1, and new features were introduced to enable dynamic memory. Dynamic memory really enabled organizations to see better density with Hyper-V. And so the levels got closer together. How many VMs you could get on a host on vSphere versus Hyper-V was very similar. Now, we've continued to evolve dynamic memory as a feature, making it easier to manage, making it more efficient to control. And VMware have continued with their ballooning, transparent page sharing, and introduced some other additions in more recent releases of vSphere. But we get a cross for that because dynamic memory is complex, and it's managed on a per VM basis. Well, yeah, it's managed on a per VM basis, but that can be very easily automated. And when we look at my environment, and we look at, let's look at this particular VM, we'll look at the settings. I don't personally think that this particular checkbox is particularly complex. It may just be me, but that I've turned it on. I've turned it off. That's it. I've turned it back on. I type in the box how much memory I want, and I can adjust these. I know this is for an off virtual machine, but in 2016, I can do the same for a running virtual machine. Now, this one probably doesn't have dynamic memory enabled, but I can still give virtual machines more memory now. I can adjust this up and down, even though I've not enabled dynamic memory. So I've got more flexibility as an admin to be more optimal with my usage of memory. So if I configured all my VMs with dynamic memory, it's going to balance and do what it thinks is right and in the most efficient way. So complex, I would say not. Yep, management at scale, you would probably manage with System Center in a more controlled way, and PowerShell would enable you to automate a lot of that as well. So not a difficult process. But when we think, one thing that does still get mentioned quite a bit is this transparent page sharing, because we don't have a feature like that. We only have dynamic memory in Hyper-V. Dynamic memory would equate to ballooning if you were looking at them apples to apples. Transparent page sharing, if you're not familiar, is essentially looking across your VMs that are running on your vSphere hosts and looking where they share pages in memory. Because a lot of VMs, if you're running all Windows Server VMs, there's going to be a lot of pages in memory that would, on paper, look the same. So they can deduplicate that and reduce the amount of memory consumed. However, the recommendation from a security perspective based on some academic research was to turn it off. And in most recent releases of vSphere, it's off by default. And in addition, if your hardware is modern as in the last 3 to 5 years, you'll have large page tables enabled on that system for performance. Trying to deduplicate large memory pages is incredibly difficult. They don't match as well as small memory pages, where it's easier to find a match and deduplicate. Large memory pages, it's a lot harder to find that match. It requires more effort to find that match. So it's not worth it. You don't gain as much, unless your hosts are under extreme memory pressure, in which case, yes, then it would kick in, assuming you'd turned it back on. But by default, it's turned off. So again, using it as an advantage, probably not that strong. Dynamic memory and ballooning are the most common that I'm sure many of you will have used. So when we think about some of the others, long-distance vMotion was a new feature in vSphere 6. It was announced, there was a lot of fanfare about it. The ability to vMotion from one data center to another, assuming you had the required infrastructure in place, not just networking, but also storage, replication, and so on. There's quite a few moving parts, naturally. But there's no comparable capability on Hyper-V. There's no way we can live migrate a Hyper-V VM between data centers unless you search on Bing for Hyper-V long distance live migration and you find results and information that, in fact, we've been able to do this since live migration was in the product. There's been no restriction on Hyper-V to say, no, you can't live migrate long distance. As long as, again, same as vSphere, you have the necessary network and storage configuration to enable replication between the sites, we can live migrate virtual machines between data centers. It doesn't have to stay in the one data center. Absolutely, it's more efficient now than it was because of advancements we've made in live migration, but still, it's still in the product. It's just not a feature that we shout all about because we just assumed people knew. It's just in the product. So yeah, back in 2010, Ben Armstrong, who we heard from in the keynote, he had it on his blog, so it must be true. He wouldn't lie to us. So back in 2010, we had this capability. So again, don't necessarily trust the document. Check for yourself. Make sure that you do know. If live migration over distance is important to you, then it's in the product. The most common live migration question that we actually get is, could I live migrate to Azure? It's like, yeah, in theory. But that would, again, require some very specific pipes to Azure, because you've got to replicate and get that virtual machine over there somehow. But for sure, it could be possible in the future. There's nothing necessarily to block it. But then there's other stuff going on in live migration. So when we think about live migration, surely it's just live migrate. It never changes. Why would you bother even improving it, Microsoft? What's the gain? Well, back in 2012 R2, we actually thought, you know what? We can make live migration faster. You think, why does that matter? Live migration, I click vMotion, it works, no downtime, Great. Yeah, but if it's faster, you can get that task done quicker and you can move on with other jobs. So for instance, if you had a big host with 25 VMs and you need to perform maintenance on that host, getting those 25 VMs migrated off in 5 minutes is better than 30 minutes because it's 25 minutes time saving that I can perform maintenance. And that's why Microsoft brought to market live migration with compression and live migration over RDMA. And in the UI, if I go back to my environment and look at my Hyper-V settings and go to live migrations, you'll see not only can I change how many live migrations I can do at any one time, so we don't say it's a maximum of 2 or a maximum of 4. You could put 9999999999 in this box and you would do 9999999 migrations at once. But you only have a pipe that's so big. So it's probably better not to use 99999 and just use a smaller number that's right-sized for your environment. The recommendation is, I think, a couple for gigabit and a couple more for, that's a very vague recommendation, but it's a small number for gigabit and a larger number for 10 gig. But here, if we look at advanced features, it's grayed out for this particular host because I've not enabled live migration. But what you'll see, am I zoom it working? Nope. You'll see I've got TCP/IP. In fact, let me enable it, and then maybe it will. Yeah, it's easier to see now. TCP/IP, that's the standard live migration just using the regular network. Compression is essentially saying, OK, you've got two Hyper-V hosts that you're going to migrate this virtual machine. These two Hyper-V hosts have spare horsepower. They've got spare CPU capacity. They're not running at 100%. We will use that spare CPU that's available on these hosts to compress the memory that's going to get sent across the network as part of the live migration. So when you click migrate, we're doing compression and sending, which means you send less data, which means the process finishes quicker. No new hardware, no specific network config, just put the radio button and go. And you save potentially a third of the live migration time versus TCP/IP. However, if you've got 10 gig links and you're using RDMA NICs, so remote device memory access NICs, so like InfiniBand or Mellanox NICs, those kind of things, we can optimize the live migration traffic to be incredibly quick. And Ben Armstrong, he can tell you the story, but they've done testing internally using RDMA NICs to migrate. And bear in mind, RDMA supports speeds of 100 gig. So we can live migrate on networks that are 100 gig. They were doing live migration so quick that the bottleneck wasn't the network, it wasn't the storage, it wasn't the processor, it was the RAM in the physical servers wasn't fast enough to keep up with the live migration. That's how quick. So think back to what I said about why it matters. We could have just said, live migration's done, it's reliable, it works, don't need to worry, it's fast enough. But no. In 2012 and 2012 R2, we made sure that it could be faster and enables you to be more efficient in the way you manage the infrastructure. Because migrating all of my VMs in 5 minutes is much better than 25 or an hour or whatever, even though there's no downtime. So, just a little bit. Now, one thing to also note is this bottom bullet here, cluster rolling upgrades. And it's something that Ben touched on in the keynote this morning, and it's something that's incredibly important because VMware has had an advantage over Hyper-V, you know, Microsoft hat off, for quite a long time in terms of how they can allow users to seamlessly move from one version to another. You've got vSphere 4, you want to move to 5, okay, you download the bits and use vCenter to upgrade your cluster. A couple of hours, done. Whereas with Microsoft, it was, well, you need to migrate VMs here, free up some hardware, do all of these different steps, jump through from some hoops, you need additional hardware, lots of steps, and probably some VM downtime. And that's the worst bit of all, the VM downtime. But with cluster rolling upgrades, which I've got a slide on that in a second, hang on. Let me just find it. I just want to jump ahead because it makes sense to talk about for a second. With cluster rolling upgrades, where's it gone? There we go. I'll come back to those other bits. With cluster OS rolling upgrades, new in 2016, we're enabling you to move from the previous release, 2012 R2, to 2016 with no downtime, which is very efficient, very useful, and enables us to say, well, okay, for that Hyper-V cluster that's got 5 nodes, 10 nodes, 64 nodes, no extra hardware is required. Just move your virtual machines off a particular host, evict it from the cluster, reimage, add it back into the same cluster. So this is the first time in Microsoft's history where we're providing the ability to have a mixed mode cluster. So a single cluster object that's consisting of 2012 R2 and 2016 nodes. That's pretty useful because that's going to enable you to migrate seamlessly with no downtime. And this is for Hyper-V clusters and scale-out file server clusters. Once you've done all of your nodes, once that cluster has finished being in mixed mode, you'll see we're now moving VMs from the 2012 R2 back to 2016. You just carry on through your cluster. Now, the painful thing here is I just talk through the process in a very manual way. Evict the node, manual. Reimage the node, manual. Add it back to the cluster, manual. Move the virtual machines to that node, manual. Repeat 64 times. Enjoy your day. Days. Well, that's one approach. And you could do it through PowerShell, absolutely. If you want to write a moderately long script to do it, that's fine. Or you could use System Center, because System Center will automate the whole thing. VMM, one of the new features of System Center Virtual Machine Manager, is enabling you to upgrade that whole cluster. So when we think about the VMware approach and the Hyper-V approach, I think we've caught up on that sense now, or at least we will with the 2016 release. It's something that should have been, in my mind, delivered a long time ago, because to enable people to embrace the next cool version, the next exciting technology, you've got to make it as easy as possible, and we didn't. And that's something that should have been done a while ago. The nice thing about using VMM as well is if you thought, well, today I'm running the GUI version of Hyper-V for my cluster, but that guy who was talking about NanoServer, he made it sound really cool. I think I'm going to try NanoServer. VMM can take a profile of your current Hyper-V infrastructure, which it knows about and understands, and deploys a NanoServer cluster in its place. So enabling you to upgrade to a nano-based Windows Server cluster instead of keeping it on the GUI version, if you want. I mean, it's up to you. So I want to quickly go back to that one point that we had on the slide there, and it was around guest operating systems. Now, we get dinged, Hyper-V gets dinged for this all the time, but we only get an orange squiggle at this point, so we obviously made it above a certain bar, no red cross. 84 fully supported operating systems. Windows 95 is on that list. Microsoft do not support Windows 95 anymore. I know that may come as breaking news, but I'm sorry, we just don't support it anymore. It's 20 years old. Now, when we think about fully supporting that, yes, it will run in a vSphere environment, and that's great, but it can't be fully supported. And there's big disclaimers on the support website that say any operating system that's no longer supported by the operating system vendor will make a best effort, but, you know, good luck. And that's realistic. I think they're not going to really truly support Windows 95 and some of the real old Linux distributions that no one in the community or commercially is now supporting. So that 84, whilst it's significantly higher on paper than what Hyper-V and what Microsoft fully support, it's not necessarily reflective of most of the operating systems that people have out there, both Windows and Linux. And on the Microsoft side, we're pretty clear about what we do support. And if this was 3 or 4 years ago, you could scratch most of those Linux distributions off this list because it was all about Microsoft, Microsoft, Microsoft. And things have changed. Things have changed dramatically. So when we think about Windows Server and Windows Client, it's the operating systems you'd expect right back to 2008 SP2. Why not SP1? Well, that's not in lifecycle support anymore. SP2 is the lifecycle supported version of 2008. So it maps, what we support in Hyper-V maps to what is actually supported in the physical world. But a lot of the Linux distributions are now supported by Microsoft as well. We've worked with the commercial and the community-led distributions to really enable that. Not only the common ones like Ubuntu, but also Oracle Linux, Red Hat, CentOS, the common ones that most organizations who are running Linux have. Now, yes, there's going to be ones on your list that you think, what about that particular version? And it may work fine. It's just we don't have anything in place necessarily to support that with that community or with the commercial vendor. So yes, we've got full support for the most common guest operating systems across Windows and Linux. That number will change, it will grow as we go forward, but then it will shrink as operating systems drop off the list. Like 2003 wasn't on there. 2003 is not a supported operating system unless you have one of those agreements, you know, those big cloud commercial agreements to continue to support 2003. But if not, it's not supported, and therefore we don't support it on Hyper-V. It will still run in the same way, it will still run on vSphere, but it's just not supported. So we've been through the upgrades. Now, coming back to the gentleman before, when he mentioned, can I deploy Nano Server to RAM? This host provisioning is, it's kind of like there's too many tools to choose from with Microsoft to deploy Windows operating systems. I could use Windows deployment services to deploy across the network. I could use DVD, I could use USB, I can use the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit, I can use System Center Configuration Manager, System Center Virtual Machine Manager. What's that, like five or six already? Different tools that I could use to deploy a Hyper-V host. Just tell me which one is the right one for me to use. Well, with vSphere, a technology called AutoDeploy really does simplify that. From vCenter, deploy your ESX hosts across the network, either stateful, so the vSphere image is deployed to disks in that host, and then the server boots and everything's great, or stateless. It's deployed into RAM, and the configuration is maintained centrally from the vCenter. Well, on the Microsoft side, yeah, we get across here. Bare metal provisioning via Virtual Machine Manager only supports initial deployment. And technically, that's still true. But the question says automated host provisioning, which we do. System Center Virtual Machine Manager enables you to centrally provision from a single source your Hyper-V hosts to bare metal, no operating system required, and it also, as the graphic represents, enables you to upgrade your cluster. Now, you could say, well, I could use Windows Deployment Services. Yes, you could. MDT, yes, you could. Configuration Manager, absolutely. But if you're looking for a recommendation on the best way to deploy to bare metal, a Hyper-V host, it's System Center Virtual Machine Manager. You define a profile, you connect to those out-of-band BMC controllers on those nodes, and you trigger a deployment across the network. And it takes 15, 20 minutes, maybe longer, for a regular Windows Server image. But if that's a Nano Server image, you're deploying 400 meg across the network to that host, that's rapid. It's going to take a couple of minutes. At best, it's going to take a few minutes on gigabit, and you'll have a new Nano Server host ready to go. It's already added to Virtual Machine Manager's management view, so there's no extra steps, which is very, very efficient. And it could be that it's going to form a cluster or it's going to be a standalone host. VMM takes care of all of that as well. But there was one key point that's called out on the VMware side around the ongoing host configuration management. What if a host drifts? What if it drifts away? We've got to think about those kind of things as well. We've got to think if the configuration changes, we're in trouble. And so in that respect, DSC, PowerShell DSC, really ensures that we keep our hosts up to date. Now, if you're not familiar with PowerShell DSC, it enables us to deliver a specific configuration to a host, and then if something drifts away, it can automatically remediate that host and bring it back in line. So that, for me, is pretty efficient. Now, when it comes to workload balancing, some of the other key areas, DRS, Dynamic Resource Scheduler, and DPM in VMware, they claim that Hyper-V and System Center only looks at the free space at VM deployment time. So I'm creating a new VM, I want to put it on one of my hosts. Dynamic optimization looks at my cluster and says, host number one, go, and that's it. Well, in fact, that's wrong. Because when we look at dynamic optimization and the settings in Virtual Machine Manager, you'll see on an ongoing frequency of configurable time, 10 minutes is what we've got on the screen there. We're just going to check that cluster, and we're going to move virtual machines around the cluster to balance it. So yes, ongoing all of the time, looking at CPU, memory, disk, network, all of those things. And in addition, enable things like power management. What if you can run all of your virtual machines on 5 hosts at the weekend instead of 10? We'll turn on power management, and we'll move the virtual machines onto fewer hosts, power down the rest, and then bring them up on Monday morning when the time is right. So all of those things, you think, OK, Hyper-V and vSphere, they're not actually that different. We're delivering a lot of the core functionality that you really need in your environment. Now, I wanted to quickly wrap up with just a couple of minutes on security, because I'm more or less on time or out of time. But I'll quickly wrap this up, because this is important. Something that's incredibly unique to the Windows OS and the Windows platform. We're doing a huge amount of security work around utilizing virtualization technology to really lock things down. So you may have heard of virtualization-based security. It's utilizing the concepts and the technology of virtualization in the operating system to guard credentials against certain types of attacks. And in addition to that, one of the weakest links in any environment is people. So with technologies like just enough administration, where I can delegate to you specific levels of administration so that you can just do enough of your job to get the task done without giving you too much control. And then with just in time, I can give you that administration for an hour or for 10 minutes or whatever it may be to get your work done. And then you give those credentials back or that privilege back. So just in time and just enough are two concepts that are in Windows Server, not specific to Hyper-V, that enable you to really start to deliver a more controlled level of security. And then there's other things in the operating system, like Windows Defender, like code integrity, ensuring the system boots without being modified at the kernel level. No rootkits, things like that. They're incredibly important from a host perspective. But then the big one, and this is a unique differentiator for Hyper-V versus vSphere and any other virtualization platform, is shielded VMs. We've talked about it in the keynote. Ben talked a little bit about the end result of a shielded VM. If you went to Lars' session today, you would have known a little bit more. But for those that didn't, shielded VMs is a way for you to protect the data of your virtual machines against malware, but also against compromised admins. What's a compromised admin? Well, you may have had a bad day or a bad week, and somebody at work has really got on your nerves, and you think, right, I'm going to leave this company, and I'm going to stitch them up, and I'm going to steal a virtual machine and get the Active Directory credentials and cause mayhem. But when you think about a virtual infrastructure, as a virtualization admin, you are incredibly powerful, because you can very easily go up to a virtualization server in your environment, even though you may not know any credentials for these VMs if you wanted to log in manually. Let's say this container host one is my Active Directory domain controller. What's stopping me as the admin of the virtualization host logging in, going to VMs? Oh, there's a container host. It might not be the same one, but that's OK. Let's look at this one. Got to find the virtual hard disk. Where have I put them all? That's challenge number one. Where did you put your virtual hard disk? There we go. There's one. Oh, what should I do with that? Well, I'll copy it to my USB disk, and I'll take it home. And when I get home, I'll mount it. Oh, look. I'm in a domain controller. This has got all of the Active Directory database and everything in. I'll take that. And I'll go and download one of many freely available Active Directory hacking kits. That's not the technical term. They're more generically known. And I'll just crack that database. And I'll come away with a ton of credentials. Nobody will have known that I've done it, because the VM is still running. I just took a copy. Nobody knows. And shielded VMs protects against that sort of stuff. Shielded VMs encrypts the virtual machine and protects it against malicious admins, whether they be server, storage, network admins, and so on, protects against all of those and ensures that your shielded VMs only run on a trusted, guarded fabric. Now, a guarded fabric is a set of Hyper-V hosts that you've configured as a guarded fabric that you know, and more importantly, that the system knows, is healthy. It hasn't been compromised at boot time. It's had a level of communication to confirm it's healthy. And as a result, when the VM tries to boot, we give it the right keys in order to boot and run that virtual machine. But if I just did the same demonstration with a shielded VM as I just showed you, I would double click and try and mount the hard drive. It would say, no, this is BitLockered, it's encrypted, you can't do it. And those secrets are all stored in a secure location using virtualization-based security and virtual secure mode. So I wanted to wrap up. In 50 minutes, we can't cover a huge ground, but hopefully it's just given you some food for thought. With NanoServer, with what we're doing with Hyper-V, with the security, there's a whole host of things that really ensure that Hyper-V is an incredible virtualization platform. And the security stuff, when the more customers we talk to, and when we tell them about shielded virtual machines after about 4 hours of discussion and how it works, people are like, yes, this is incredibly important. Service providers, enterprises. And like I say, Hyper-V is unique in this technology. There's no other virtualization platform that has a shielded virtual machine capability. So, in summary, please come up and see me later on. I can share more resources, share more decks and stuff. It's been a pleasure to talk to you now and this morning as well. And I'll be around for the rest of the day. So please let me please stop by and say hello if you've got any questions. And yeah, thank you very much for your time. And we'll see you again.